Welcome to the Martin Bailey Photography Podcast. It's April 13, 2015, and this is episode 467. Today, I bring you our first tour participant feature with Rick Andrews, a wildlife photographer from Alberta, Canada, who joined the first of my two Japan winter wildlife tours for 2015. I always do my tour updates with my own photography, but I thought it would make a nice change for you to see the tour from a participant's perspective. Rick and I had discussed how photographers market tours with their best images from multiple tours, but as Rick says towards the end of our discussion, this is a great way for you to see what's possible from one tour and what is essentially, for many, the first chance to shoot in the locations visited. Anyway, I won't give away too much right now, and this is going to be the audio version of a video podcast. If you would like to just watch the video and follow along with Rick's commentary about his photographs, then go to the blog post at mbp.ac/467, and you can watch the video embedded there. Or if you would prefer to listen, just continue listening. The rest of this is going to be the audio from the video. And just go to that blog post and check out Rick's beautiful images at your own pace. Okay, let's jump in and listen to my conversation with Rick Andrews. Rick Andrews, welcome to the Martin Bailey Photography Podcast.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you for inviting me. Pleasure to be here.
That's great. I've been looking forward to this. So that people understand what's happening here, Rick is a photographer from Alberta, Canada, and he was one of the participants on the first of my two winter wildlife tours for the snow monkeys in Hokkaido this year. I've been asked many times, you know, I do my reports after each trip where I go through and show people the photos that I've made during the tours. But a lot of people have said, well, you know, what about the tours, the photos of the participants? And this year Rick and I were talking, and I thought it'd be a great idea if we actually just had him come on the show and talk us through some of his work. So that's what we're going to do today. And I've been really looking forward to this. Before we jump into that, Rick, tell us a little bit about how you got into photography.
Okay, I think I have probably been in photography for most of my life. I got my first camera as a child, and it was one of those, you know, plastic ones with the built-in flash that used to burn the fingerprints off your off the ends of your fingers there. I progressed through a variety of cameras, SLR 35 millimeters and that kind of thing. And finally, I think about 10 years ago, I went digital. Mm-hmm. So I've made the progression through, and it's been a very good experience for me because I think I've learned a lot of the basics along the way. Mm-hmm. I've also done a little bit of photography, family snapshots and a little bit of landscape, urban landscape. Wildlife photography, but I think at the end of the day, I'm a real nature lover. I enjoy being out in the outdoors. I enjoy watching animals, and being able to photograph them are equally enjoyable to me. So I think if I were to point to one thing that gets me out of bed in the morning, it likely would be wildlife photography.
That's great. You know, I've got to show this before we go on. I just want to, you know, this is a photo of you from the workshop that I shot. And this, you said there, you know, you like watching animals. It was great watching you just being in those locations and doing your thing. So I just thought I'd get this. And I still love your hat, you know. Was that Tibetan, did you say?
It's fairly new. I bought that in Canada actually just before I left, and it was actually made in Nepal.
Nepal.
So it's a genuine Sherpa hat, I guess. And I don't know, it had a little bit of character, and I thought, you know what, I got to get that thing and wear it. So
yeah, well, I'm glad you did. It was very you. Brilliant. So let's take a quick look at a few photos. If you could share your screen, let's take a look at a few photos. Sure. As well. From before the trip, Okay. Not necessarily before, but
sure.
From some of your representative work, and then we'll start to look at your images from Japan.
Okay. So you can see this one, okay?
Absolutely, beautiful shot.
Okay, this is a shot of a polar bear that I took in Manitoba, Canada. This is up just outside of the seaport of Churchill. And what I like about this shot is, and what I try to do with a lot of my wildlife images, rather than just filling the frame with the animal itself, I like to try to include a little bit of its habitat. So that it gives us a little bit more information about not only the bear, but, you know, where they live. And I think that this one adequately displays the harsh environment that these animals can somehow not only survive in, but they also manage to thrive as well. This next shot was taken here in southern Alberta, and a lot of people are surprised to find that we actually have pelicans here, but pelicans come in the summertime and they settle on our rivers and our lakes and our ponds and that kind of thing. And they're quite an interesting bird to watch. And this shot was taken in late evening, just as the sun was going down. And what I liked about this was that the pelican itself is highlighted, and yet it forms such a very small part of the overall image.
Yeah.
And the trees in the background and the reflection in the lake, I think adds further elements of interest that somehow just pulls all of this together.
Mm.
So this is one of my favorite shots, I guess.
You know, I've got an old shot very similar to that, only it's a swan, and I agree. I mean, they're beautiful when you get them just that the bird itself highlighted, and because they're white, they really, the contrast is incredible. I love it.
Well, they do, and I waited for probably a half an hour for that pelican to swim into position. But that's part of wildlife photography as well, right?
You just
got to have the patience to go along with it.
Yeah.
This one here is of a long-billed dowitcher. It's part of the sandpiper family. And this is shot at one of the local lakes, probably about a half an hour away from where I live. And in a way, it's almost minimalistic in that, again, the bird forms a very, very small portion of the overall image. And then, of course, we get the grass and the mud kind of sticking up through it, and the dowitcher is busy, just feeding there. But there's something, I don't know, about these kind of shots that kind of attract me to them. And these are the ones that I'm looking for. They're a little bit different, a little bit out of the ordinary, but seem to capture the viewer's interest.
Mm, yeah, excellent.
This next one I shot up in Alaska last year, and to me, there's probably nothing more iconic in northern North America than these muskox. You'll see them, up through the Yukon and Nunavut and of course in Alaska as well. And I think what they're doing here, they're somewhat startled, I think, by the fact that we were, driving down the road and then stopped to get out to photograph them. So in a defensive mechanism, what they try to do is to form a circle. It's kind of circling, the wagon around the youngsters, so to speak, only they're a little bit disorganized here. But again, I think that this not only gives us a view for, what the animals are, but we can see from the way that their long fur is blowing there that it's quite blustery and windy. We see a little bit of the tundra in the foreground and, kind of these stark mountains in the background. And again, it gives us some understanding for the type of environment that these animals live in, which up in Alaska, this was taken in probably around mid-June, so it's not going to get a whole lot warmer up there.
It's beautiful shot.
Thank you.
Look at this.
And this one, by comparison, is taken in northern Montana in the in Glacier National Park. And the mountain goat, again, is kind of an iconic animal, and as the name implies, that, it lives up in the mountains. I was somewhat restricted in what I could do in this shop because the environment up there is so fragile. You can see all of these wildflowers, and they have such a very brief season up there that you're restricted to walking along a boardwalk. And and so I couldn't really move my position a whole lot. And again, I was really happy when this goat decided to move to the edge of this alpine valley and, you know, have a look down below there. So, you know, the mountains in the background, I think, provide just enough of a hint that, yes, we're up in the mountains here. Mm-hmm. And, you know, sort of very close to tree line kind of thing. So, so those are... and I guess I have one last shot. I thought that was it, but I did select this one here. This one I shot last fall down in Wyoming, the Grand Teton National Park. And what I liked about this was, again, it includes part of the woodland scene that the moose will typically hang out in. And this was in fall. And just off to the left of this picture, there are two cow moose. And the day before, this bull had run off a young pretender that was looking to take his harem from him. And I think in this shot here, he was sensing that he may be coming back. And I'd seen this overarching branch from this cottonwood tree and thought, you know, that would be really cool if I could somehow get a shot of him positioned, you know, underneath this arch. And as he sensed this other bull, he began to walk in that direction. But of course, he was, you know, he was walking away from the camera, and it was, you know, basically I'm saying under my breath, okay, turn around. and almost on cue, he stopped and turned his head as if to say, you mean like this? And and I snapped the shot, you know, but that was it. So I shot this one with a very wide aperture, so that the depth of field was really, you know, narrowed down to roughly the area where the bull moose is standing. So the background gradually blurs as it gets further away, and you know, the sagebrush in the foreground here is a little blurred too. But I just like the way that this image came out. It has almost a painterly type of effect to it. Yeah. And again, it's maybe a little bit different than getting a shot that's just, you know, tack sharp all the way through.
I mean, the first thing I saw, as you say, was the arch. It's perfect the way he's there. It's just, yeah, very well composed and beautiful shot.
Well, thank you. I'll try to switch back now to the collection and hope I don't mess it up here. Okay. So,
excellent.
You're seeing my first shot from the workshop?
Yeah. So for the viewers, what one thing I wanted to just let you know, we start this trip with 3 days in Nagano, which is about a three and a half hour drive northwest of Tokyo, and we spend those first 3 days with the adorable snow monkeys before going up to Hokkaido, the northernmost island of Japan, for 9 days. So Rick's going to start off here walking us through from some of his snow monkey shots.
Sure. I just need to go full screen on this again. So let me, there we go. Well, these are, of course, the famous Japanese macaques or snow monkeys. And they are, to my understanding, the most northerly primate. Yeah. You know, typically we're used to seeing pictures of these macaques in, you know, tropical rainforests and jungle settings and that kind of thing. So it was important to me in coming to Japan, if we're, you know, going to be photographing these primates, that I wanted to, you know, get at least one or two shots of them where they're actually in the snow. And this provided also a little bit of a challenge because, you know, you've got this bright snow and then you have an animal, you know, with different colored browns in its fur there. So trying to get something that balanced out so you don't overexpose the snow or underexpose the animal there was a little bit of a challenge, something that we worked at. But I think, Martin, you suggested maybe 1.5 or 2 stop overexposure on the compensation there, and that seemed to work fine. So that's essentially what we have here. I think this monkey was foraging in the snow for some rice or something to eat there, and just happened to be looking off at some other monkeys in the distance, and you know, it worked out reasonably well, I think.
Yeah, beautiful. Yeah.
This one here is a little bit different. This was kind of a preconceived idea I had into my in my head when I was traveling to Japan, thinking, you know, we often see pictures of the snow monkeys in the hot springs, but, you know, what can I do that's maybe a little bit different? And this shot wasn't exactly the way that I'd envisaged it on the way out, but because of the, you know, number of people around the pool all, you know, jockeying to get in position to get their shots, it always seemed like the one that I wanted was like a foot or two over to the side. And of course, I couldn't get over there. So in the end, I decided, well, you know what, let's just take some shots and see what happens. And and this one here was one of the ones. It's a fairly significant crop, but I think I was in close enough with the 1DS3 there that I was able to, you know, still get away with chopping out some of the megapixels. But what I like about this, I think, is, you know, the color, also the, you know, the patterns, the shapes, the contours, that kind of thing. And I think, again, it sort of all comes together. I'm not quite sure what it was I was trying to achieve in the shot, but I just like the way that it came out.
The amazing thing with the snow monkeys is that their hands are so much like ours, apart from the hairy bit. But you know, they're just so human, aren't they? When you're sitting around them, and hands are one of the things that makes us a lot different to, you know, especially with the opposable thumbs, what makes us different to other animals. So it's great when you see the hands like this.
Yeah, I agree. It's one of those things, particularly with primates, that there are characteristics that, you know, we identify with, and they may not look exactly the same as humans, and you know, thankfully they don't, but it is one of those things that we can easily relate to, I think. So, yeah, being able to see this, it was like, well, okay, so again, it's something that I think we can relate to in a number of different ways.
Excellent.
Thank you. So here we see the mother with the yearling infant. And again, from my understanding, grooming is very important to macaques, particularly in terms of socializing and building social bonds between families and troops and that kind of thing. So in addition to providing good hygiene, it's also something that they do on a fairly regular basis. And I when I took the shot, I thought, you know, this is really cool, because first of all, you can tell that this mother is just really into it. She's just really enjoying this. And when you think of the sacrifices that the mothers make on behalf of, you know, the babies that they have, and the amount of care and attention that they need for, you know, the first couple of years of their life till they become a little bit more independent, it's really nice, I think, to be able to see that, you know what, the babies do appreciate that, and this is their way of showing some appreciation by, you know, giving back to the mom kind of thing. So again, I think we all appreciate what it's like, you know, and the enjoyment we get from having a hot bath or being in the hot springs, and certainly, you know, that comes across in this shot too, that we're not the only ones that feel that.
Yeah, you know, that's probably a 2 year old or maybe three. It's the one year old ones are the really small ones. They we go in January, February, and they're actually born about 8 months before that, in the April or May of the year before. So
yes, yeah,
those really small ones are the yearlings.
Yeah, well, I call them a yearling once they reach a year old, and as you say, you know, they were born last year, but are not maybe quite a year old yet. So you're probably absolutely right that this one is at least a year, two, possibly even 3 years old. It's a little bit bigger than
I would say is at least, he won't have been last year, he'll have been the year before at least. But still, it's great the way they, you know, they just get into this grooming and the social thing, and they just, you know, they're amazing to watch. And this photograph really does pull that together.
They're very captivating creatures, and it's just something when you get there and you're watching them and photographing them, it's like, you know, you don't want to leave. It's like, oh, well, look at this one. Look at this one.
Right.
So this one here is one of, I think, probably last year's youngsters, because I believe this one is still nursing, and that's what was going on in this particular shot. But again, we don't see much of the mother. We just see, you know, the fur and on the one side of the frame there. And I think for me, it's the eye of the youngster there that kind of, you know, makes this image. It's gazing off to some distant point that, again, we're not quite sure of what that is. But for me, this shot kind of demonstrates the fragility of young life and the security that, you know, the mothers do provide their youngsters. And you can see that, you know, this youngster here just doesn't have a care in the world.
Yeah, beautiful.
This one is one of my favorites. You know, we were talking a little bit earlier about the, you know, the different ages of them, and this one here would likely be a couple of years old, maybe even three or whatever. Mm-hmm. But these ones are the rambunctious ones. While the other ones typically, you know, stay a little bit closer to their mothers, these ones are a little bit more independent, and they're tearing all over the place, playing tag and, you know, slapping each other about a little bit. And it's almost like, you know, this one jumped into the pool and, you know, if I sit here and suck my finger, maybe nobody will notice me kind of thing. So,
you know, I think this is the one that's actually got the bad finger, and he, you know, how you see how he's got his finger up giving you the bird. I've seen photographs of him, and he's actually just sitting in the pool. I think he broke it when he was young, and he can't bend that finger, so he actually sits there looking around, giving everyone the birds.
Yeah, exactly. But again, these are the kind of shots that you can get, and I think this was probably taken with my 24-105, so you can get, you know, relatively close to these animals. They are well habituated to people, and it's just a joy to be there without the heavy lenses and everything else, being able to, you know, get some fairly decent close-up shots with not very much glass at all.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, let's go back here a little bit. There we go. Oh, there. Yeah. One of the other opportunities that I'd hoped we would get, and obviously we did from looking at this, was getting some shots of the macaques where they're maybe a little bit more active, maybe where they're running around outside of the hot pool. And I think it was the equivalent of 2 days we were there, like a morning and an afternoon and a full day kind of thing. Gave us ample opportunity to look around and see what else was happening. And when I first came down to the stream, you know, the macaques were crossing it, but they were all heading in the wrong direction. And because the other side is actually an animal reserve, you know, we weren't permitted to be over there. So basically had to sit around waiting for these macaques and hope that they would actually come back. And then when they do, of course, they're very quick. They don't spend a whole lot of time crossing this thing. So it took me a little while to get the camera settings just right and to get the timing right and everything. I think this one obviously was shot with a high-speed burst, and then I just pulled out, you know, the one frame that seemed to capture the moment, so to speak. So so these are, you know, again, they're shots that are easily obtainable with just a little bit of work and you know, a little bit of patience.
Yeah, it's very well done. I love the fact that you've got the very fine snow in this one as well. That adds so much to the image.
There's a little bit of snow in there, and then there's also, you know, the trail of water just coming off his rear feet, and
yeah, that's and magic.
That kind of stuff. Yeah. So it is. It's one of my favorite shots, that's for sure.
Great.
Nice. This shot here is of a black kite, and we don't have these in North America that I'm aware of. I've never seen them here anyways. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of a lifetime first for me. I believe this was shot at the Crane Center on yeah. one of the days when we had some pretty good sunshine. And the photography that I've done, particularly with raptors in North America, you know, we in Western Canada here, we have a lot of very clear blue skies. Mm. And so when you have the raptors flying above, they're typically highlighted, you know, from the ambient light that's shining down from above, which then leaves the underneath of the wings often in dark shadow. Mm. And so it's always a challenge to be able to pull out enough detail in the wings without overexposing the sky, and of course without losing detail through underexposing the wings. So it's always a little bit of a balancing act. Mm. And I think on this particular day, because of the snow on the ground and the light that was reflecting up, mm. it gave us an opportunity then to have this bottom up lighting that I think really helped pull out some of the detail in this shot.
That's exactly what happens. I mean, it's like you've got a big softbox underneath the flying raptors, so it's great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the other thing I like about it is that he happens to be looking at the camera. It's almost mm-hmm. Like the neighborhood kid on the bike going by, look, ma, no hens kind of thing. Right?
So this, again, for the sake of the listeners, this is actually the first day, the first location that we visit in Hokkaido. So we've left the snow monkeys now and we're up in Hokkaido in the Akan Crane Center.
Yeah, in Kushiro, I think it is.
Yeah.
Is that right? Yeah. So while we were up and in around that part of the country as well, we headed over, and my Japanese pronunciation is not very good here, but I think this is the Notsuke Peninsula.
Notsuke.
Notsuke? Okay.
Notsuke Peninsula,
Okay. And this is an Ezo deer, a stag. And while we have deer in Western Canada that I can photograph on a fairly regular basis, we are used to seeing them either in a woodland setting or out on the prairie someplace. It's very unusual for us to see waves behind a deer, and particularly waves that are crashing on the beach. So for me, that was a little bit of a novelty. And then to include snow in that same shot as well was another kind of unexpected element. But again, we're getting that ambient lighting reflection from the snow here on the stag that's striking this beautifully majestic pose.
Mm, it's great, yeah.
And, he didn't hold it for very long, so it was one of those things where you have to try to anticipate what's happening and then, react to it as quickly as you can. And fortunately for me, he stood there for a few seconds anyways, and then I was able to snap a few shots, including this one with the waves breaking behind, which
it all came together, didn't it, for that one?
Yeah, it did, and I was quite happy with that one too.
Mm.
While also out on the peninsula, we also got an opportunity to do a little bit of landscape photography, and as you can see, there's a certain bleakness to that part of the peninsula in wintertime. Mm. A little bit of, maybe a little bit of a minimalist type of image here, but while the trees are the central focus point of this image, I also like the horizontal lines that were likely created by, the blowing wind and snow and that kind of stuff as well. Mm. And again, it creates, I think, an element of interest that, just wouldn't be quite the same if it were just solid snow with very little detail or contour between, the foreground and the trees.
Mm, mm.
So that
foreground and the ground behind the trees that's the inland sea. That's the peninsula itself is literally just about maybe 20 meters either side of a road, and that's the full width of the peninsula. But then the inside here is all inland sea, and so it's great. I mean, this was actually on the second tour. It was so warm this year that parts of that inland sea were actually thawing, which was crazy for February. It just doesn't happen. Global warming or whatever it is, but it was quite warm on the second trip.
Yeah. Well, and you know, it's interesting because of course the only time that I've seen it is in winter. So sometimes it's very difficult to discern what is land and what is water when you've got snow on top of it. So this would have been, I think, perhaps either the last day or the day before the last day of the trip. And I've kind of mixed up the order here a little bit, but this is Oshinkoshin Falls. And I think what I like about this picture is the contrast. And I don't just mean the tonal contrast or the black and white contrast, but you know, we're looking at essentially the same element here, whether it's water, whether it's snow, whether it's ice, it's just in a different elemental state. Mm-hmm. And what I really like is that, we've got all of the, you know, the different elements displayed here, but then we also have that contrast between the hardness and the harshness of the ice and then the soft water just, you know, falling over the rocks behind it. I like the contrast, you know, of all of those things as well in this shot.
Yeah, nice stuff.
This was, I think, just across the road from the stop, the pull out there for Oshinkoshin Falls.
Yeah.
And again, this is the sea, right? This is the sea ice, with the cliff kind of in the background and a little bit of sparse vegetation here in the foreground. Yeah. So it just, you know, blends away, you know, the horizon melts into the sky and it's very hard to discern just exactly where the horizon is.
A little bit of a
different shot, but you know, that was one of the things I appreciated from the workshop was that we did get a chance to try some different things, and you know, it wasn't all wildlife and it wasn't all landscape, so it ended up being a nice blend. And this was, I think this was as the storm was coming in or as it was going out, and I can't quite remember now, but I believe these are the apple trees, right?
This is over near Tsurui, where we go to the bridge, and yeah, this was as the storm that locked us down started to come in.
To blow in, yeah. And I remember when we got off the bus and, you know, looked at the scene, Martin, you were, I think, a little bit disappointed that some of the grass was actually showing through. I think you were hoping that there'd be a little bit more snow there. But, you know, I think this shot would have worked both ways. Certainly, it would have been much more minimalistic with just all snow cover and just the trees there. But I think the snow showing through, it adds those, you know, three diagonal lines to this image, which, again, I think creates some interest. So, as I say, I wasn't, you know, overly disappointed. I think the image, you know, would have worked both ways. And as it was, this is what we got and had to work with. And I think that was fine.
And I love the way you've composed this. I mean, with the three lines, and you've made the most of the situation, which is what you're great at. So yeah, I totally agree.
Thank you. This was, I think, the first day at the Crane Center. And what I found really challenging there was to try to isolate, you know, just two birds like I have in this image, because there's just so much going on with the other cranes, with the, you know, the swans, with the crows and everything else that happened to be there. So I found it a little bit of a challenge to isolate some birds sometimes, but once in a while, as in this shot here, I got lucky.
You got very lucky. I love this. I'm envious.
What I like about this is the feathers from the bird that's, you know, got its rear end stuck towards us there, kind of thing. And with the light, with the detail that we can see in here, it reminds me very much of the petals on a flower, perhaps something like a parrot tulip or something like that, where you have, you know, all of those rough edges. But it's one of those unique shots, I think, that works probably better in bright sunshine than it would in very subdued lighting, because then that way you don't get that, you don't get that contrast. But the other thing I liked about this was that both birds seem to be sounding off at the same time, which is a little bit unusual too, because usually one will call and then the other will call, and then they sort of alternate. And
they usually both have their heads up at the same time, though. The call itself, the male does his honk, and the female goes honk honk in reply. But they generally both do have their heads up like that. But I mean, this is just when I saw this, I was envious. It's a beautiful shot. Perfect timing. And like you say, I mean, the thing is that you see these scenes, but we're generally pretty much locked down to our position that we choose. And it's the look of the drawer as to whether you can get a clean shot through or whether there's something else in the foreground or background. And and when you get them doing something and you get that clean shot right through, it's just magical, and you really nailed that one. It's great.
Oh, thank you. This one here I think is probably my favorite crane shot, and I think it's because it is so different. This was for sure as the storm was coming in. I think this was the third day when you said, you know what, we should go back to the crane center because we've had 2 days of sunshine there, and snow is just going to add like a totally different element to it. Yeah. And you were absolutely right. And for this shot here, it was, I'm sure I shot this with the 500, as these two cranes were just gliding in. And it's a fairly slow shutter speed, maybe around 1/50th of a second or something like that. And I don't think I was panning. I think this is just actually the snow that was blowing in and the fact that these birds were just gliding into position. But when I downloaded this and looked at it and then began doing a little bit of post-processing on it, I just love the way that these colors are kind of coming out. There's magentas, there's greens, there's cyans, there's all kinds of things that are going on in the background. And yet, we still see the birds in perfect detail, and and this is just, again, it's one of those painterly like shots that I never really anticipated taking, but was fortunate to be able to take advantage of when the opportunity presented itself.
Yeah, and again, you've got them framed really nicely in that sort of dip in the trees, and it's beautiful. Hey, Rick, do you want to just move your mouse over to the left a little bit, because it's over the photo there.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay.
All right. Beautiful.
Thank you. And this was, let me see here. There we go. This was very early in the morning down at the Ottawa Bridge.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is that's how it's pronounced?
Yeah.
And I know that we didn't get quite the effect that you were hoping for. The night was just not cold enough. I think what we were looking for was more of the hoarfrost on the trees and a little bit of snow and that kind of thing. But on the one side of the river, we still did manage to get that in a very localized area. Yeah. And fortunately, it stayed there until some of these cranes wandered down the river far enough so that they could, be included in the shot.
But
again, one of the things that I really enjoyed about the workshop was the opportunity to shoot, the same wildlife, but in different settings. That was something that I really appreciated, because had we been at the Crane Center for, 3 days and that's all we, would have shot, then it might have, got a little monotonous or whatever, because how many shots can you take at the same location, 3 days in a row kind of thing. So I did appreciate the fact that, we were able to go to some other locations and end up with shots like this.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, it was very localized. That I was, it's always amazing when the whole river goes white like this, but at least we had that patch where we could get some shots, which is better than sometimes, because it doesn't happen every time we visit, and just having even just that little bit was great. So I'm glad you maximized that on the opportunity.
This shot here is again one of the ones that I visualized in going to Japan. I'd done a little bit of research about cranes, and you know, the dancing that they do during the mating rituals and that kind of thing. And I really hoped that I would be able to get a shot of them doing that. And again, I was quite fortunate with this one, although I think I have to admit to using the crow removal tool in Lightroom just to kind of clean the shot up a little bit, you know, and get the distracting elements out of there. But, you know, as you'd said quite a few times, Martin, the snow falling down with, you know, kind of obscuring the trees in the background just create this magical background for these shots that... without that snowfall, it's just not the same image. So I was again happy that we did go back on the day that it was snowing, and I could get the shot that I'd envisaged on the way out.
Yeah, great, beautiful.
And this is a red fox that we took and photographed out on the, well, we didn't take the fox out, we photographed it out on the peninsula there. And what I like about this is, you know, the lighting, the detail, and there have been discussions that I've listened to between wildlife photographers. You know, some of the purists will say, well, you know what, you should never take a picture of an animal that's looking at you, because that's, you know, something that wouldn't happen if the photographer wasn't there, so therefore it's not acting naturally. I've heard other photographers say, well, you know what, it really doesn't matter because we as humans, you know, place a great deal of emphasis on eye contact and that kind of thing. So when I was taking the shot, that was sort of playing in the back of my mind, and I actually shot it both ways. So I do have some images of the fox where it's looking directly at the camera as well. But I chose this one because she's looking out of the frame, and we're not quite sure what it is that they're looking at, but I find myself wanting to turn my head to see, you know, just exactly what it is. And of course we can't do that. So it adds an element of mystery because, yeah, it's looking off into the distance. Obviously something's captured its attention, but it's left to our imagination to decide, you know, what that might be.
Yeah, it's nice.
Thank you. I really like the shot, but you know what? I'm really envious of the yawning fox that you got on the second workshop. Oh, there.
You know, that was magical. That was that was crazy the way you did that.
That would have been awesome.
Yeah.
This one here, I'm always looking for something maybe that's a little bit out of the ordinary, a little bit unusual. And I've read statistics that say some predators, and particularly mammals, are perhaps only successful 15 to 20% of the time. I haven't really read anything about raptors and eagles and that kind of thing. But this one here kind of gives us some clue that, you know what, these Stella's sea eagles are not always successful either. And, you know, again, this is something that you just have to, you know, take as it happens. You can't predict that this is going to happen at all, but when it does, you know, and you look at the LCD, you know, viewer afterwards, you look at this and you think, wow, he missed it. He missed it. Yeah. Look at that. There's the fish.
Yeah. And the
other thing I like about this is that, you know, between the feathers on his wing there, you can just see, you know, his eye that's just poking through there. And the expression on his face is like, "Doom!"
An interesting fact about these birds, the Stella's sea eagles actually steal 70% of the fish they eat from younger Stella's sea eagles or other eagles. The first year eagles, as soon as they've sort of stopped getting food from their parents, they have to, of course, start to hunt for themselves. And then they'll usually take it somewhere to eat. They'll take it to a perch or something. And the statistics are that the older Stella sea eagles only catch 30% of what they eat themselves, and they steal the other 70 from other animals. And it's usually younger Stella sea eagles. So if you think of it that way, a young Stella sea eagle's actually got to catch like three times more fish than he actually will ever eat, because he's going to get 70% of it stolen anyway. So
yeah,
they actually, in some ways, that helps them to become better hunters, but they also, they're not 100% as you might think they are.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Great animals, though. I mean, just look at it. This was just outside of the harbor area there, where we'd gone out. There was no sea ice because it had been so warm again. It was actually this year the sea ice was more than 3 weeks late. It was pretty crazy, but we made the most of it. And you did with this photograph as well. It's, because the alternative, of course, is having them catch fish off the top of ice where we throw it, and it's not that brilliant. But this is totally natural, although the fish is frozen, but you can't really tell that from the photograph.
Yeah, exactly. And again, it's just, these birds are opportunistic, and I think as photographers we have to learn from them and also, take advantage of the images that we can get. And
absolutely,
certainly, like I say, you couldn't predict that this was going to happen. You just had to keep shooting and, hope that you got it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, even down to that little, the fact that his eyes poking through the end of his wing there, it's just perfect. It all came together and, a great shot.
It did. Yeah. And, this one here is pretty much full frame. So again, I was lucky, not to clip the bird's wings or, part of the spray behind it. It just worked out just perfectly. And that was more by, good luck than anything that I did as a photographer. So, sometimes you have to be lucky.
There's a degree of luck with what happened, but you need the skill to have your, to have it framed up and to have it in focus. And, so you don't rob yourself of that, Rick. It's, it's still a beautiful shot, and there's a lot of people that would have missed it. So, it's a bit of luck, but there's a lot of skill behind it as well.
Well, thank you. This one here is an airborne, of course, Stellos sea eagle, and you're right. I mean, these are beautiful birds, and when I first saw pictures of them, and I think it was on your website, I thought that they probably rival a bald eagle in terms of their appearance, because they have that beautiful, dark color that contrasts, so nicely with the white feathers and then the yellow beak and everything else. And their shape, their features, particularly the beak of the Stellos sea eagle is a little bit odd when you're used to seeing the more smooth contours of the bald eagle. But, I think I like this eagle just as much in appearance as I do the bald eagle. Mm. They're just amazing birds to watch. They're huge. Like their wingspan has to be probably 2 meters or more, right?
The wingspan on a full grown adult Stellos sea eagle is between 2.4 and 2.5 meters. So it's like 9 feet. They're incredibly, they're the largest eagle. They're just huge.
They're huge birds. They really are. And again, as I talked about a little bit earlier, it's difficult sometimes to be able to get enough detail in the feathers underneath the wings when you're shooting up into a blue sky like this. But I was so amazed when we were on the boat that day that the lighting conditions were just almost perfect. And again, we were getting that reflected light from the water coming up and illuminating these birds. And, once we got the boat positioned to be able to take advantage of that, it was just, it was magical.
Beautiful.
So this was, I think, the first day after the snowstorm ended, and Martin was feeling really bad that we'd been holed up in the hotel for a day or two there, but he kept us occupied. And you know what, after being on the road for a few days, I actually didn't mind a little bit of a more relaxed pace in the hotel. But to make it up to us, Martin took us to this location where he'd heard there were a pair of Ural owls. And actually, we saw two pair that day. So, how lucky are we, right?
But it was amazing. This is beautiful, isn't it?
it was just a wonderful opportunity to go there and to be able to see these two birds. And of course, they nest in the hollows of trees, as you can see from this shot here. And this was in, you know, broad daylight, and they just happened to be so relaxed. One of the things that I'm always conscious of as a wildlife photographer, and one thing I try not to do, is to unduly stress animals out. Mm. And for me, a good experience is being able to go in and get your shots and leave the animals exactly as you found them. Mm. And I don't think that there's any better way of saying that, you know, these birds here are completely stress-free by having them sleep through the whole experience.
Yeah.
So everything about that was just magical.
Yeah. Beautiful shot.
This one here is of the whooper swans, and this was at the Crane Center. And Martin challenged us to try some slow shutter speeds, some panning, just to see how things worked out, to come up with maybe some slightly different images than what we'd been taking for a couple days previously. And this one here was, I think, quite slow. It was about a 1/25th of a second, if I remember correctly. That's but what I like, right. Yeah, what I like about it is the almost the mirror image between the two swans. We've got the one swan above with its wings extended up above its body, and the one below where the wings are down below it. And there's nothing remotely sharp about this picture at all. In fact, you know, the swans themselves are totally blurred as well. And yet we can just see there's enough detail there to be able to tell that these are swans and that they're both, you know, flying together. The background is completely blurred out. So again, it creates a very artistic shot that, you're not really able to predict how these things are going to turn out at the time, because you take a series of shots and you try to pick the ones that you think are going to be the best. And quite often the wings are not quite right, or there's something in the shots there that just doesn't make them work. But again, I got lucky in this one.
Yeah, it's beautiful again. Yeah.
This is, again, in the same place, whooper swans coming in. And again, this was as the snow was starting to come in now, the blizzard is starting to blow. And these birds are all coming in and just gliding in on their final approach to land in the field and to take shelter from this impending snowstorm.
Yeah.
What I like about this shot is that the birds look as though they're somehow luminescent, like they're being lit somehow from within. And when you see that in contrast with, you know, the tree and the snow and everything in the background, it creates that nice contrast. And again, I think I got very lucky in this shot, because there are six birds, and typically it's very hard to get a shot where you can see all six of their heads. Usually one of them is, you know, hidden behind a wing or something like that. And yet in this instance, it just all came together. And again, it's perhaps, they say luck is where opportunity meets hard work or something like that.
But I
think I got lucky in this shot.
Beautiful again. Look at this.
Now, this is one of the white-tailed eagles. And Martin, you're absolutely right, because I was hoping to get more shots of the Stella Sea Eagles, but they were just basically sitting back waiting for these guys to go and catch the fish, and then they would just basically rob them. So being able to photograph these guys, we got a chance to do that, with a little bit more opportunity than we did the Stella Sea Eagles. But I found after a while, you know, and I was trying to get them as they would just go into the tuck position like this, as they're diving down and picking up speed to, you know, pick up the fish out of the water. Yeah. And I found that by watching these guys for just a little bit, you could almost predict when they're getting ready to do that.
Yeah.
And of course, shooting from the boat, were handheld and with lighter lenses. I think that, I didn't have the 1-400 back then, so this would be my 70-200 with a 1.4 on there, so not quite 400. but certainly a lot easier to be able to take handheld, and with a little bit of luck and a little bit of anticipation, you can predict when they're going to start to go into this dive, and this is probably one of the better shots I got of it doing that.
Yeah, it's great. Love it.
One of the things I always try to do when I'm photographing, if I can, if it happens to be a moose or a deer or a bear or whatever it is, I'll also try to shoot from either a kneeling or even a prone position, so I can kind of mix things up a bit and get some low angle, low perspective shots. Mm. And of course, that's very difficult to do when you're on the boat, because you're standing on the deck, which is, you know, a few feet above the water. But this bird was out far enough that it almost gives that perception that, I'm just, you know, I've got the camera maybe about a foot above the water there, which really wasn't the case, but it just kind of came across in this image. And while I do have, you know, lots of other photographs of them sort of taken from the deck looking down, this one looks as if you're looking straight across at it. And therefore, again, it's something a little bit different and something that I found appealing.
Yeah. Oh, beautiful. Yeah. It's great.
And I think that is it. I think that's the last shot. No more.
Wow. Well, beautiful. Thanks. If you want to hit that stop presentation or the share screen, the screen share button will get you back.
Okay. Exactly.
But that was great, Rick. I really enjoyed looking through your images. Of course, I've seen them, but it's also very nice to just hear you talk us through that. I think it's the first time we've actually done this, had a participant from the workshop on the podcast. So I'm excited to have been able to do this. I think it's something that I'm going to try to continue. I've been talking with someone from the second wildlife trip who we're probably going to do this with as well. But I've really enjoyed it. And it's, you know, because obviously I like to show my work as a photographer, but also I understand that people don't necessarily want to see the trip from my perspective only. So I think this is something that will be useful for the, you know, the listeners of the podcasters or the viewers today. And I mean, as a marketing exercise, I'd love to be able to just say, okay, we'll go to mbp.ac/ww2016 and book for next year, but it's actually already full. So both of next year's trips are already full, but this will at least also give the people that are already signed up for next year something to look at. And just as a general photography exercise, I think it's great going through your images the way we've just done. So the marketing aspect is not necessarily the thing that I need to be thinking about, because it was a lot of fun. So Rick, as the people, we had your lower thirds there, but people can find your work, some of your other beautiful work as well, at rickandrewsphotography.com. Is there anything else that you'd like to add before we drop off?
Well, I'd just like to say that I think from a marketing perspective that this would be advantageous. From my perspective, I've been in other workshops, I've been on other tours, and quite often what happens is that you'll get the pro photographers that are shooting and showing some of the shots that they have taken. And of course, they've accumulated those shots over probably several years. They've just taken the best ones from each one. So I think this one here will help people to understand that these shots were all taken within, you know, a 9 or 10 day period or whatever. And that was it. That was just the one time. And I think that anybody with a little bit of photographic background could have achieved the same thing that I did. And just looking at some of the other images that some of the other participants, you know, shot on the bus and that kind of thing, I don't think my images are any better or any worse than anybody else's. So I think anybody going on your tours would certainly have an opportunity to get very similar pictures to this. The one last thing I would like to add is that if, and this is completely unsolicited, but if anybody is ever considering going on one of Martin's tours, I can say again, because I have been on some other workshops and pretty much gone all over North America, that Martin's tours are amongst the most organized tours that I've ever been on. He typically puts you in a position where you can get the shots, and even, you know, when the worst snowstorm in Hokkaido's history rolled in there, we got dumped with 1.8 meters of snow, if you can believe it, within 2 days. Martin and his people there were able to, you know, complete workarounds for us. I don't think there was anything at all that we missed in terms of wildlife. I think the only thing was we didn't get to photograph the whooper swans on the lake, but we still got to photograph the whooper swans at the Crane Center. So we didn't really miss anything. So I would not hesitate, if you're thinking of going on one of Martin's workshops, that, you know, I don't think you could do better. So unsolicited, and there it is.
Thanks so much, Rick. I'm pleased that you notice those things. We try to keep the glitches out of the matrix. And I mean, it was honestly the most challenging trip that we've done so far. We were locked down for 2 full days, but we pulled a few extra things out of the hat to keep the momentum going. And I mean, you're right. By that time, it was the weekend. We start on a Monday and we go through to 12 days later on a Friday, and it was the Saturday and Sunday that we were locked down. And by that time, people are starting to get a bit tired. So it's normally at that point, we do start to have some half days in the hotel. We do workshop sessions, and that just ended up being 2 days because we couldn't even get down 15 minutes down the road to the swans. But, you know, I think we pulled it around, and I, from my perspective, wanted to just say thanks to you and to the other 13 people that were on the trip with us, that, you know, for being so patient, because it could have been a lot worse if you guys had all mutinied. You know, you were all very cooperative and flexible, and so I appreciate that as well. You helped us to make it as successful as it was under some circumstances, so thank you as well. On your other comment, you know, I think you're being a little bit modest again, which is obviously, it's not a bad thing. I see photographs from the trip. I think you've definitely come away with better images than some people, because this is what you do. You know, you do the wildlife photography as, you know, one of the main parts of your photography or your photographic life. You came away with a great crop of images. Everyone does come away with some good work, but I think that you consistently capitalized on the opportunities that you're presented with. So a little bit of modesty coming in there as well. But thank you very much. I mean, it really is. It was great sitting looking through your work, and you know, let's keep in touch, and hopefully we'll get to travel again at some point, as you know, together again at some point as well.
Absolutely. And thank you, Martin. And yes, if our paths do cross again, which they hopefully will sometime in the future, then I'll certainly look forward to it.
Okay. Well, so if people are listening to this on YouTube or, you know, or find it some other way, I will also post some of Rick's images on the in the blog post that we normally release with each episode. And this one will be at mbp.ac/467. It's episode 467. So if you want to go over there, you'll be able to see the images. And I'll probably just put them all in an album so you can click through them all, with Rick's kind permission, of course. But really, thanks very much, Rick. And it's been a pleasure. And I look forward to meeting and chatting again.
Yeah, same here. Thank you, Martin.
Thank you.
Bye now.
Bye.
That really was a lot of fun. Thanks again, Rick, for joining me for this conversation. Of course, you know, I've talked about the tours being full, but we do get cancellations from time to time. And for most tours, we have a couple towards the end where people, just for one reason or another, cannot join us.
and we end up emailing out to a number of people that have joined our cancellation list and getting them on board. So if this video and our conversation does convince you that it's worth joining me on one of my tours, then by all means, let us know. Also, there are other tours. We've got the Hokkaido Landscape Tour that we're doing next year again, and that's a pretty special tour. The areas that we visit are still pretty untrodden by the tourist crowds. We go to places where we just don't see another bus of load of tourists, or any tourists at all for that matter. And of course I've got my Iceland tours with a few spaces left, and a couple of slots on my Namibia tour this year still, with Jeremy Woodhouse. So go to mbp.ac/workshops and take a look at the other tours that we've got available as well. And of course, all of these tours are yearly things, except Namibia, we don't know about that, but Iceland and my three Japan tours, they're yearly events. So if you're picking up on this later, then you can still hopefully get in on a future year. But as I said, this is really not about the marketing so much. I really just wanted to bring you Rick's work and show you what people can achieve on their first visit to these locations. So thanks very much for listening today. If you enjoy this podcast, please share the link with your friends. And if you don't already, please subscribe in iTunes or your favorite podcast program to ensure uninterrupted delivery. You can find me on Google+, Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. And links to everything that I'm up to are at martinbaileyphotography.com. So do drop by and take a look. I'll be back next week with another episode. In the meantime, you take care and have a great week, whatever you're doing. Bye-bye.